702.
The Aubrey Masango Show.
Live, online.
Smartphones, DSTV.
92.7.
And 106 FM.
Not introducing, but welcoming fellow interlocutor Nicole Engelbrecht, host and founder of True Crime South Africa podcast. Nicole, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Aubrey, for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
What is our preoccupation with crime and criminals? Why do we find them so interesting, Nicole, to the point where Nicole Engelbrecht starts a whole podcast, which is doing so well that it's crazy, yeah? Aubrey Masango, on the other hand, has a slot on his show that is very popular. People wanting to hear more about crime, talk about crime and criminals. What is our preoccupation with crime and criminals?
Yeah, Aubrey, I think it's twofold. I think that firstly, it's a global thing. It's not just in South Africa that people have this interest in true crime and criminals. And I think it's partially, you know, you were saying just now that people like to separate themselves from the type of person that could commit a murder. So I think that's part of it. I think we like to hear, or we're fascinated with these stories because we want to try and identify all of the ways that we think these people are so different from the so-called rest of us. You know, that's comforting to the so-called, you know, the people, the rest of us. You know, if we think that they, you know, murderers and people who commit these crimes, such as Rosemary and Lawu, the alleged crimes, are very different from us. So yeah, that's one side of it. And then I think the other side of it is the victims. You know, obviously we have great empathy for victims of crime, but I think there's also a secret part of us, you know, that in consuming this content, we hope to find the secret to not becoming one of those victims. So, you know, I think that's a twofold equation where that fascination comes in my mind, at least.
What was the reason for you starting your podcast?
So, I've always had a interest in the true crime genre and, you know, crime fiction as well. And I've always consumed the true crime podcasts and YouTube channels that the US have and the UK have. And, you know, I've always searched for South African cases and why didn't we have any coverage like this of our victims, you know, in South Africa? And that started getting me thinking, and, you know, then I started to see all the good that was coming from the podcast, the true crime podcasts that were happening across the world, where they were creating awareness in these cases. Some of them were actually helping to bring in leads to solve cases. And I thought, you know, South Africa can really do with something like this.
Yeah.
So I couldn't find one at the time, a South African true crime podcast. So I guess I decided to start one.
What was the crime that would have been the inaugural conversation that led to, you know, true crime South Africa being such an example, I suppose, but also such an how should we call it, a success?
I think it's difficult to say. I think that, you know, the type of cases that I hope to present to South Africa through True Crime South Africa would be the ones that aren't necessarily covered in the mass media, so
yeah,
not the, you know, the headline murders. So that's my hope for the podcast. And then interestingly, I do find that a lot of my listeners do tend to enjoy the solved cases more. So, you know, the cases like the Fumbada murders were very popular, and I did see a huge increase in listenership when I covered that case.
I'm finding that people are fascinated indeed, yes, with the idea that people are brought to justice, and so the, you know, conversations about at least the Funbradar case, or perhaps the Norwood murderers that we've recently talked about, the many of those kinds of cases, the Krugersdorp murders and so forth, that we've spoken about, tend to give a sense of feeling that, how should we say, that there is such a thing as justice, that even the most cleverly conceived crimes are ultimately caught. I mean, criminals are ultimately caught out. But I'm also finding, Nicole, and I don't know whether you're finding this too in your podcast, that there is another level of intrigue and interest, and that is a sense that I wish these people weren't caught. Do you find that?
That's another an interesting one. So definitely I think that from the perspective of listeners and people consuming this content wanting to know that people, you know, the so-called monster is locked in a cage. But yes, maybe there is that sort of vicarious, mystery effect to it, where people sort of, you know, wish that the mystery could endure. Because, you know, let's look at one of the most famous cases in America, which is the Zodiac Killer. He was a serial killer who to this day is not being caught. And, you know, that's still one of the most popular cases covered on many podcasts and true crime programs.
And a movie was made out of that, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. It was partially fictionalized, but so several movies, podcasts, documentaries, books, you know. So, yeah, there's definitely something to what you're saying there.
And the very fact that many of these crimes and criminals are the stuff of great content, you know. I mean, we write books, we have podcasts, we have shows about it, we have movies written about it. What does that signal to you about us, about society and our relationship with crime and criminals?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because, you know, I think that the psychology of these people is something that interests people a lot. But it's also, you know, the background. And again, I think it comes back to, we hope to perhaps understand these people to a certain extent, so that we can be assured that ourselves and perhaps those around us are not like these people. And then also, you know, it's a morbid fascination, and we can't get away from that. You know, to a certain extent, that is what it boils down to, where it's like driving past an accident on the road and, you know, you shouldn't look because you're going to see something you wish you hadn't, but you still look.
Yeah.
You know, it's human nature, I think.
I love to go to soccer matches or rugby matches. Not necessarily because I'm too interested in the game. I'm fascinated by the spectators. I'm thoroughly fascinated by the spectators. And I suppose I bring that kind of approach to discussing crime and criminals. I am fascinated about which team ultimately wins or loses. And, you know, I mean, I like that kind of stuff. But I'm fascinated by, totally intrigued by the behavior of the spectators and the seriousness with which they take this whole thing, and the fact that there are industries that that grow out of this situation where 12 guys or 15 guys are going to break each other's necks in the middle of. So understand why I approach stuff the way that I do. But
yeah,
you've been looking at a number of crimes, and I want to start off with a crime that is really got us talking in South Africa at the moment, and that's the crime of former Tembisa constable, what's her name, Ms. Ndlovu, Rosemary Ndlovu, who's alleged to have killed family members, who is alleged to have plotted to kill even more people, including the station commander of the station, while she was in jail, I'm told, yeah? What do you make of this case? First of all, I want to ask around the behavior. I mean, I'm sure you've been watching how she's changed the behavior in court. One moment she's very exhibitionist. She's laughing and talking to journalists, and she's doing all sorts of strange sort of exhibitionist things. Then another day she is throwing stuff at the very same journalists. She is morbid. And this is somebody that's alleged to have killed close relatives, boyfriend. What do you make of this case?
Yeah, so I think it's difficult to make sort of speculations about behavior until we have a court ruling.
Yeah.
But I think that, we can sort of understand if I was in that position. You know, I think 90% of us would certainly not be behaving in that way. So I think that, if we look at how she is behaving, the swings, in emotion and the, posing for cameras and chatting up journalists, there certainly speaks to, there is something there that is not, I hate to say not normal, but there's something additional there that needs to be looked at, and that has certainly, if she is found guilty of these crimes, has most certainly led to her being able to do these things without having any empathy for victims who were related to her. I think a good case that we can probably compare it to is the Krugersdorp murders.
Yeah.
When we saw Cecilia Steyn in court. And, she perhaps wasn't as
theatrical,
swinging from one emotion to the next. But she also certainly did not behave in a way that most other people would if they were accused of 11 murders. I think certainly, if she is found guilty of these, we'll be able to make deeper speculations, but there's certainly that's something not quite right, unfortunately.
Now, isn't that what she's counting on? I mean, whether or not she is found guilty of these crimes, if she has committed them, and, we need to remain very careful and use the right words, allegedly and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But is an individual that is able to plot the death of the most intimate of relatives and succeed in doing it and see it through, right? It is perhaps of a mental state that is perhaps a little more devious than the rest of us, I would imagine. And what we would consider to be psychologically, or perhaps even not just psychologically, but psychiatrically abnormal, right? Isn't she counting on that? Isn't she counting on the idea that there are cameras around her? She's literally documenting the erratic behavior that she's showing in order for her to ultimately say, I'm not well, and some clever attorney to be able to push that legal agenda to say, no, this person is not well, let's plead insanity here.
Yeah, look, I think that, firstly, she has, I don't know for sure that she has, gone for any sort of psychiatric assessment, but if there were concerns of that, any mental health issues had played into her crimes, that would have been something the court would have got out of the way right in the beginning. So, for her to use that in her defense, she can certainly try. And you might be quite right. She might be, swinging this way and doing it deviously to try and use it in some sort of mitigation of sentence at the end. But in terms of whether, even if she has some sort of personality disorder, which is quite likely if she is guilty of these crimes, it would have had no bearing on her crime. She would certainly wouldn't be able to plead insanity if she has a personality disorder. So But you're quite right. She could definitely be doing it on purpose, or she just might like the attention.
I mean, the very fact that she was a police officer would suggest that she knows her way around how the legal system works and so forth and so forth. The alleged crimes that she's accused of are not crimes of passion. They are crimes of absolute greed. Maybe just straightforward, practical, utilitarian crimes, right? I'm interested to take calls perhaps from our listeners on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. My guest is Nicole Engelbrecht. She's a host and founder of the True Crime South Africa podcast. She talks about crimes like we try to do here on this particular segment. Give me a call and let me know what your thoughts about the case of Nomia Ndlovu, who is now blaming insurance companies for registering relatives as her spouse. What do you think is going on there? Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. I'm interested, Nicole, about your thoughts about the criminals that you and I talk about and their relationship with the communities from whence they emerge. So let's take Henry van Bredaar, for example. Comes from a very insulated, secure, well-off background that for all intents and purposes would not inspire anybody to kill anybody or anything. Never mind your own family and in the way that he's done what he's done. What are the motivations based on the conversations that you've had?
So to approach the community question at large, I think there's two aspects that play into it. There's the micro community, which would be the family, and then there's the macro community, which would be, you know, the community at large around it and whatever socioeconomic circumstances might exist in that sort of macro community around the perpetrator. And I think that, you know, when we discuss psychologically motivated crimes like the van Bredaar murders, the motives are often very difficult to pin down, because it looks like, in his case specifically, it looks like he had everything he could ever ask, from a money perspective. So, you know, most people could not understand why he would want to kill his parents. You know, but there were other psychological aspects there, obviously, that played into the reason that he did that. Allegedly he had felt, singled out in the family and, you know, all of these things. But, from a community perspective, the community plays a large role it plays a large role in the development of a perpetrator, but the sole responsibility always rests with that perpetrator.
And the way that we deal with them, the criminal justice system, the prosecution process, the litigation process, the way that we even talk about the motivations as perhaps psychologically motivated crimes versus greed crimes. Are we not perhaps trying to tell ourselves a story as society that may be untrue? In other words, that there are people that do the most evil things, but they are explainable in sympathetic ways. In other words, so there are certain people that we say, this is a crime of greed. It's not necessarily a crime that is psychologically motivated. It's but then this crime is psychologically motivated, right? Could it be that all crimes of the nature where somebody has the potential to get something are ultimately motivated by greed. The complexities, the degrees to which that person may fall within our ambit of the reasons why, it becomes academic. But actually, ultimately, the fundamental reason why people will kill other people is because they aim to get something out of that process.
Absolutely. And you're 100% correct, Aubrey. The only difference is, what are they hoping to get? Is that thing physical or is that thing psychological?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, does it really make any difference? Probably not. It certainly doesn't make a difference to the victim or to their family.
Yeah.
But yes, as society, we want to know why. And that's a very important question for us, is why. I think we want to know why, because we hope that if we know why, we can present it next time. And sadly, that's not always the case. So interestingly, in South Africa, in a South African court, you don't have to prove motive. You don't have to, that's not something that is important to the South African justice system.
Yeah.
I'd be 100%
clear. And the reason why I asked that question is precisely because of the families or the victims in that situation, where sometimes the justice system asks questions and goes through processes that seem not to acknowledge the pain of the victim and the victim's family.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that our justice system, from the cases that I've covered on the podcast and the family members that I've had the privilege of speaking to, the trauma of violent crime goes far beyond the incident. It goes far beyond a perpetrator being found. It goes far beyond sentencing. It is unfortunately at this time perpetrated by certain parts of our justice system that are not working the way they should be. So I think that we definitely have some work to do in terms of developing a system that, still is just and, is not just locking people away for the sake of it, but is also serving the victims primarily, because they should always be, forefront of the conversation as far as I'm concerned.
Mariah in Sandton, good evening to you. Your thoughts?
Hi, Aubrey. So nice to chat to you again, and I trust you well.
I'm well, thank you.
I'm well, thank you. It just struck me that I think there is some leeway for differentiation in terms of crimes, and not that I'm an expert, obviously, it's just my opinion, but it's like if it's somebody who's been abused, be it a child or a woman or what have you, sexual, emotional, what have you, abuse, and finally, plucks up a courage, which is what I would call it, to kill that person. I have sympathy for the person doing it. In other words, I kind of like applaud it. I mean, maybe shouldn't say that, but I do.
Say that again, Mariah. What do you do? You applaud what?
I applaud those who kill those who've been abusing them.
Oh, I see. Okay, yep.
Yeah, and I think that's different to somebody who killed somebody like, allegedly this the former police constable or what have you, for ostensibly greed, from what we understand of the news up until now. And I think that we were discussing like the Shannon Wright man and so forth. And I think that given that she took all these, life insurance policies and so forth, she was in her right mind. In other words, she didn't just do it out of being insane or not knowing what she was doing. It seemed she knew what she was doing. And I think that is different to somebody who's been abused for years and finally, gets to the point of enough is enough and I'm eliminating this person out of my life. Yeah.
You see, Nicole, Mariah, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's the dilemma I sometimes have.
Sometimes,
around whether somebody is performing this crime because of greed or because there's a psychological problem because they were abused. In certain cases, we are not told about the possibility of abuse. So, for example, in the case of Ms. Ndlovu, the former police officer, the narrative generally has been about how she's been a police officer and how she was conniving and greedy and so forth. But the conversation hasn't gone deep enough to find out what was her upbringing. Why is she this way? Whereas, for example, in somebody perhaps who's a little more well-heeled, like Henry van Bredaar, for example, we start to hear that, no, there were certain psychological issues. I can't remember which are those two kids that skinned people alive. Or which case was that?
Yeah, that was the Valcom murders.
Yeah. We hear how they had psychological problems because they killed little birds and so forth. I don't want to racialize, nor do I want to give the issue a classist sort of conversation. But all of these people have participated in heinous crimes. And I'm worried about how we have the conversations about those criminals, the societies that they come from, the backgrounds that they come from, with some level of equity, of consistency in order for us to find the objective motivations. I'm the first person to say, yes, all crimes are not created equal. I'm the first person to accept that. But I worry about my content, and as somebody that also deals with the same kind of content, about how we talk about these things. I mean, I haven't talked about Ms. Ndlovu because I'm checking myself. I'm checking myself as to, and I've listened to some of my colleagues talk about it, other radio stations and so forth. The narrative is just too easy. Right, it's just too easy to say, oh, this one is motivated by nothing but greed. But we've done none of the work that we've done about somebody else. Let's take the Blade Runner, for example. Right? You know, we did the work. We went back into his childhood and we found out. We started trying to figure out why he loved guns so much, why he shot somebody under the table at the rich. You know. And so the question I'm asking is for you and I, as people who are interlocutors, who are facilitators of conversations about crime, should we not dig a little deeper in the way that we narrate and talk about the issues?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. So I think that you present a very good point, you know, and we've got to look at it from two aspects. As a public looking in on the issues, are we casting people with the same brush? Are we affording people the same level of, as you say, background and all of that sort of thing, regardless of where they come from, whether they've, you know, what they've done in their lives? And then also, you know, there's a legal issue, you know, because their defense attorneys are supposed to present these things, but we well know that even that is not equitable because, as you say, a person like an Oscar Pistorius can, I'm very sure, afford a much, you know, better attorney than someone who may have been a police officer, you know. So there's certainly that level of equity that needs to be looked at, and that comes back to the victims as well. You know, some victims seem to be more interesting and we're willing to do more work to find out who they were than other victims.
Yeah.
And the same goes for perpetrators.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that gets raised a lot, especially when I cover serial killer cases. And it's often because people who do go on to become serial murderers often do have terrible pasts that involve some, you know, some form of abuse. And people say they feel conflicted because they want to feel sorry for the person, but they don't feel sorry for them, you know. And I always say it's okay to have empathy for the child that, you know, let's take Moses Satorley.
Yeah.
It's okay to have empathy for Moses Satorley, who was a child and who was abused.
Yeah.
But we don't have to excuse his actions as an adult because of that empathy. We can do both.
Yeah. 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 We can eat and walk at the same time.
So, yeah.
Now I hear you. give us a call on 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. We're talking about crime, criminals, and those who talk about them. The societies from which those criminals emerge. The reasons why we have the conversations we have about crimes and criminals. Is it because there's a selfish, self-placating motive behind us? The good people, the good citizens? Is it perhaps because we see ourselves in some of these criminals and there are certain things that we see that are uncomfortable about them but are very close to us? Do we have a right to condemn them? And what about justice and the management of society? After having those deep philosophical conversations, what of the management of society and the fact that we can't have people going around skinning people alive? You know? So give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. Tony is an Eldos. Good evening to you, Tony.
Hi, Aubrey.
Yeah.
I don't know whether, she has been, this lady has been referred for observation, but, the manner, her behavior and the way that she answered the questions, I think that something must have prompted either the judge or somebody who's involved in the case to say, listen, let's refer this lady for observation. Because, you know, sometimes the manner in which the crimes are committed, that can also be an indication that there is psychologically something wrong there.
But the very fact that the crime is committed, Tony, the very fact that a person can calmly plot the death and successfully see it through and then go and fetch the money and then have a pretty comfortable life as a result of the proceeds of that. Shouldn't we already know that there's something wrong there?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, somebody must have, before the trial started, come up with that. Because, you know, the prosecutor obviously has the docket. The prosecutor knows what the case is against her. And that in itself should have prompted the prosecutor to say, listen, let's refer this lady in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act for observation. The brutality and by not doing that, they are doing herself, a disservice, as well as the court, I believe.
Tony and Eldos, Nicole?
Yes.
I mean, do you think that the first port of call by the judge in this case should have been, after seeing the exhibitionism, the media coverage of the story, the theatrics and throwing of chips at journalists one day, talking to them and posing for them and telling them that she's got, that the first thing that should have been done is that she should have been observed by psychologists, right? And I'm asking why? Because the very act is already a sign that there's something wrong. I mean, a person who kills 7 people, maybe not by her own hand, but by her own mind, is already troubled, I would argue.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we certainly need to put out there that we don't know that she hasn't gone for a period of observation.
Sure.
That may well have happened. If it has not, then there is a very good chance that either the judge, the prosecutor, or the defense, does not feel that any sort of conditions, disorders that she may suffer from may have impacted her crime. So in the type of crimes that she's accused of, you know, you're very likely going to see some form of personality disorder. But that personality disorder, whether it's, you know, a level of psychopathic tendencies or a narcissistic personality disorder or, you know, anything of that kind, is not going to remove her guilt if that guilt is
yes.
found.
Yes.
It may not even be a mitigating factor in sentence, you know, because just to give you a crazy statistic, they say that only 7% of psychopaths in the world are actually in jail or have committed a crime.
Any of them are running our countries. Sorry. You just walked into that one.
Well, you know, they say that they are, you know, psychopaths do very well in positions of political power, yeah. in religious leadership, you know, running businesses. So, you know.
Aren't we in trouble? It's just all right. Let me quickly take a call from Anonymous in Attridgeville. Hi, Anonymous. Yes, sir.
These people who kill people, they plan those things. And this lady.
You mean Ms. Ndlovu? Yeah.
Ndlovu.
Yeah.
She planned that thing, and she's now now acting as if she's local. There's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with her. You know, I lost my precious son in 2015. Okay.
Yeah.
And then things that happened before his murder, a week before. Ne?
Yeah.
Scary. I followed that thing until I gave up in 2020. And the national commissioner, she told me, insisted that they must open the case. But the very same person who said who work hand in hand with me abandoned me. And then came with a story that it was an inquest docket. And yet...
Yeah.
The national commissioner said the case must be reopened and investigated.
Mm.
People, there was a premeditated murder. And I haven't got justice, but I made peace with myself. And the murderer is very somebody very close. Very, very, very close, and she's eating my child's benefits because he worked as a policeman for 22 years.
Anonymous, I'm going to let you go there. Thanks very much for that call, and you can hear the pain, the abiding pain in Anonymous' voice, Nicole.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the sobering reality of what we're talking about tonight. You know, we can talk about it in an abstract way, but that is the sobering reality of a parent who has lost a child to violent crime, who unfortunately has not seen the justice that they deserve. You know, that's the basis of what we're talking about here.
What should happen? I mean, we have criminal justice systems all over the world. For all intents and purposes, it appears that crime, particularly violent, murderous crime, is on the increase. Do we go the Saudi Arabia route? Eye for an eye. Do we go the Scandinavian route to really go through the process of understanding the motivation, the psychology, and what do we do here? Do we kneel down and pray? What do we do?
Yeah, I think it's a multifaceted question, but I think one thing that we need to understand is that as much as sometimes our justice system does not work in our favor, we, if we compare it on a global level, we are, believe it or not, far ahead of many countries. In terms of the types of sentences we give in type, in terms of, you know, just our systems and our processes. And I know it doesn't work for everyone. And, you know, with the level of crime, violent crime seeming to increase, I personally believe that comes down to a community and socioeconomic level. The more we see, you know, children being made to be adults before their time, the more we see, you know, as poverty increases, all of those elements, in my mind, you know, add up to violent crime increasing. So it's really not a one, for me, it's not a one, you know, one facet solution. It really needs to start at community level. And, you know, when I cover these cases on the podcast, I always say, you know, if you really want to make a difference, start in your own home and start in your own community, because that's where you really can make a difference. That's where you can change a child's life so that he does not become the next guy that's sitting in the dock accused of heinous murders in his adulthood.
Nicole Engelbrecht, it was wonderful talking to you, host and founder of True Crime South Africa podcast. How do we get the podcast? When do we listen to the podcast? Give us those details, please, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You can listen to it whenever you like. That's the beauty of it. It's available on all the podcast apps. So it's available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere where you're getting your podcasts, or on, if you want to listen on the computer, on Iona FM as well.
What's the next crime story you are going to be talking about?
Tomorrow morning, actually, so I release every Friday, that's when the new episodes come out, and tomorrow morning I will be chatting about the Rosemary and Dorothy case, actually.
Nicole Engelbrecht, I will be listening. Much appreciated. Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome.